the What's the Crack podcast with Anthony Martin.
Listen in live weekly on Brighton's Radio Reverb.
See whatsthecrack.co.uk and radioreverb.com for showtimes.
This week's guest is a bit of an Irish music legend. He is a founding member of trad band Keela and the extremely popular band The Frames, who celebrated their 25th anniversary last year. He released his second solo album, And Now the Weather, in April 2015. And this week he plays here in Brighton at the Unitarian Church as part of the Great Escape Festival. That should be an electric gig. On the phone with me right now, it's Cullum McInumera. Hello.
Hi, Anthony. How's it going?
Good. Now, looking at your CV, you've had and you live a very musical life. You come from quite a musical family. Is that kind of where you got the background for music?
Yeah, I suppose both my parents are musical, and my granny played the violin, and, you know, my mother played violin and piano, and then both parents come from the west of Ireland. And my mum comes from a kind of classical background, and my dad comes from a shamus background, so that's unaccompanied traditional singing. So I suppose I had the tradition on one side and kind of classical training on the other.
Hmm. And was that something that was kind of in the household growing up then, where was there always like music being played?
Yeah, I mean, there's six kids in the family, and all of us play something, and, you know, there were good parties, put it that way, between relatives coming in and whatever. Everybody would have to be doing something, singing or reciting a poem or playing a tune or whatever.
Cool. And when did you pick up a fiddle then? Was that kind of early on?
I think, age seven or so. I think my older sister was practicing her violin, and I used to sing along to her pieces, so they decided to buy me a violin. I think that's how the story went.
And you grew up in an Irish-speaking household as well, I believe.
That's right, yeah. First language. My dad comes from the Gaeltacht, which is Irish-speaking area of Connemara in Galway. And, my mum actually spoke Irish as well in her house. So they decided to raise our kids speaking Irish in Dublin.
So when you're in that mindset of thinking in Irish, it's quite a lyrical thought process, I think. Would that kind of translate into music then? Do you think that's kind of something that accompanies that?
Well, I think any sort of bilingualism, I think more and more research is revealing that it has all sorts of benefits, from, you know, staving off Alzheimer's to, you know, any number of other things. Yeah. I think for sure, just it gives you a wider understanding and of the world we live in, which is kind of so diverse. So I think with one language, perhaps you're just tethered to kind of one operating system, whereas having more than one kind of frees up a whole lot of just thought and understanding of our neighbours, you know, on the planet. But and musically as well, that's true. You know, it's a different types of music. So I think in a way, I was bilingual musically as well, through having the folk element and the traditional, you know, Western classical tradition as well, you know.
Yeah, and your first foray into music as a kind of a band then was in Cláiste Éin in Dublin. How did that come about? How did you set up that band?
I think both schools, the primary school that I went to as well as the secondary school, Cláiste Éin, had a great ethos, a musical ethos, you know. So we would have all learnt kind of traditional tunes on tin whistles in primary school, and then that moved into Cláiste Éin in secondary school. I was good friends with a lot of the lads in the band, which was Keela. So the Snuddy family were friends of ours and my family, and we used to playing to the houses of kids, and then we got more into music then, and we started entering these competitions called Fologa and different sessions, and then about age 14 or 15 we went busking on Grafton Street. That's when I think that was a turning point in my life as a dad, kind of, and in everybody else's, actually, in the lads from Keela are playing. So that was kind of where you're in a way stepping out of the leafy suburbs and getting into town and kind of meeting real life and, you know, spending time on the streets. And that was a turning point, really. And that was, in a way, the beginning of kind of process of running away with the circus.
Yeah, you talk about a turning point. I suppose you met a fellow busker on Grafton Street, Glenn Hansard. How soon after that did the Frames form then?
Well, I suppose I would have seen Glenn play on Grafton Street about late 85, 86. And I think then over the next 2 years, there was kind of, you know, different groups of buskers would kind of... were initially wary of each other, and then over the process of maybe 2 years, we kind of started playing with each other. And then that kind of peaked in 88, 89, and then in 1990, he put the Frames together.
Yeah.
That made up of, you know, some of his busking friends. And I was one of those friends, I suppose.
Yeah, and did you have kind of dreams of being a musician professionally then at that point?
I definitely had, yeah, for sure. I think the playing music on the street kind of concreted that idea of just the romance of it, you know. School quickly became a drudgery and a chore. You know, when you compared it to kind of the freedom of just playing on the street and making some money. And I think at that stage, Glenn and Nicholas were certainly by 1988. I think they were sharing a flat in town in Harcourt Street. So back to their out of school already, made it even more alluring.
I will write you letters that explain the way I'm thinking.
Actually, the music scene in Dublin was kind of thriving at the time, wasn't it? Like a lot of bands coming up at that stage, and as you said, Mick Christopher, Glenn Hansard, and yourself busking on the streets of Dublin. It must have been a great time musically.
Yes, it was. I suppose you had bands like, say, the Hatter Flowers, who were a couple of years older than us, busking as well, and then they were, I suppose, doing quite well in the early 90s then. And also the stuff like the Waterboys had moved to Dublin, like Mike Scott and stuff like that. The other bands were in Tuonua. So there was a good scene. And I suppose that the late 80s as well, was that whole phase of, business people, music business people had been, you know, looking for the next U2 kind of thing.
Yeah.
That thing, that whole... feeding frenzy had just happened,
right,
in a way.
I suppose the Frames then went on to get a lot of success, I guess. What was it like at the peak of that success?
Well, it's hard to see what the peak was, really. Because it kind of it melded into the movie that happened in 2007, the Once movie.
Yeah.
And in a way, kind of the Frames ship got repainted as the Swell Season. So much of the, you know, audience, well, obviously the audience grew hugely. But I think, yeah, from the minute the film came out, the Frames were kind of eclipsed. And I suppose it took me a few years to process the the idea that you know, you couldn't really kind of go back, but the genie is out of the bottle, and it was kind of a case of, yeah, you can only have forward momentum or forward movement.
Yeah, and you speak of that, I suppose in 2008 then you came out with your first solo album, The Hare's Corner. Was that something that was playing on your, like, did you want to do a solo album for quite a while, or was the success of Once kind of, was that a bit of a chance to get a clean break, do you think?
No, well, actually, there was a bit of time off, and that's what kind of presented the idea. I'd been doing a good bit of soundtrack work, scoring TV programs and stuff like that, documentaries, and I think that just got me more thinking in personal musical terms rather than I'd been kind of habituated to being an ensemble musician and thinking of the we as opposed to the me. It just kind of happened quite accidentally where I was working on a cousin's soundtrack for a series he was doing about sailing in the west of Ireland. And I just realised that after that project finished, I actually had a lot of material and that it would be nice to make an album. And that's one kind of one tune followed another. And it's great. And it was such an enjoyable experience, I think, that I think from that moment onwards, it was a case of, yes, I'll definitely have to pursue this more.
Yeah.
And then over as then the swell season became more established, and then it became clearer that, where my heart lay, really, when that was certainly in making my own music. You know, I think you get to a certain age where I think being in a band involves a huge sacrifice and compromise. And when you get to a certain age, you're less happy to make those compromises and sacrifices.
Yeah.
The concrete steps, you know.
Yeah, like do you feel you're kind of more in control of your own destiny, a master of your own destiny now in terms
absolutely,
of your music?
Absolutely, yeah. I think across the board. Because I think for, you know, when you're talking about being in a big band, and I suppose the numbers as well in the band grew to it being a 5-piece to being a 10-piece and an 11-piece, and this is from the Frames to the Swell season.
Mm.
So you realise that your input is less, and also that you know that ultimately the person who's calling the shots, you know, could make any decision, could, you know. It could all be over tomorrow. So I think just having lived like that for so long, I think it's just reached the point where you just need to be able to be in control of your own life. And and that's been immensely satisfying, I have to say.
Yeah, and you actually went out and released a second album as well last year, second solo album, and now The Weather. What inspired the name of that album?
Well, my father was a newsreader back in the 70s and early 80s, and so I suppose the phrase "Exhibition in Hampshire" is an Irish-speaking newsreader, and now The Weather would have been something that would have lodged in the recesses. But there was a particular news bulletin that I heard one morning on the radio, and I think it was after a kind of a very gruesome, bulletin of, you know, one disaster after another. I can't remember whether it was Gaza or Iraq or Syria or whatever. But and then with the kind of the background of kind of global warming and all that, and kind of the newscaster kind of sighed and Tripoli said, "And now The Weather." Kind of the irony kind of struck me. Yeah,
we've become blunt to bad news, haven't we, in kind of recent years, I guess.
I think so, for sure, yeah, no doubt about it, yeah.
And that album as well, it was nominated for a Choice Music Album Prize. Now, I've seen your responses online. You're quite surprised and taken back by that.
I'm not surprised, as in, you know, I'm not kind of so, you know, it's not kind of like mock humility. It's a case of, I think, that being in the music business for so long, and that you become a bit kind of you don't take anything for granted, shall we say.
Yeah.
So that you don't assume these things, or you don't assume that competitions and quality equate the same thing, shall we say. So I think the thing that I was grateful for and thankful for was the fact that, you know, we live in the digital age, and that we are just bombarded with information, and our attention spans are so pleasing that that it can be a really useful thing to be included on shortlists of any sort, you know.
Yeah.
And I think that was a victory in itself.
Yeah, I suppose it's always nice to get your work acknowledged as well, isn't it? In any
absolutely,
form.
Yeah. Whatever it does, whatever it does.
speaking of kind of your work then and your life in music, what lights your creative spark now?
Well, any number of things. You know, I think the thing that keeps me going is the fact that you don't know what the next project is going to be, because I've kind of diversified into, you know, I think that being in a rock band was quite it just became quite a predictable trajectory for me. So nowadays I'm kind of going between projects of collaborating with poets, scoring long poems, working on theatre, working with like children's theatre. I just scored a movie recently about the Kerry Babies trial, which was a kind of that happened in the 80s in southwest of Ireland. So it can be the creative spark can be it's just really diverse and I think that's what's interesting for me. If I were kind of you know, hiding away in my own garret and kind of, you know, obsessing over what the next thing is going to be, you get kind of into it. It's very easy to get kind of, create your own cul-de-sac.
Yeah.
Whereas I think thankfully, the way things are and have been and kind of set things up, that I'm kind of far more open to inspiration, really, you know. So I think it's nice to keep that level of freshness of not knowing, being able to surprise yourself and kind of, you never know what the next phone call is going to come from.
Yeah. I suppose it must be quite stimulating as well doing music to a kind of a visual accompaniment, as you said, with the TV and the movie and the theatre as well. It must be a different process.
Very much so, yeah. It is. It is for sure. And I think and each kind of process informs another process in a way, so that it's a constant learning curve. And but there's something, there's a potency of like either, you know, working music to live actors or animating an inanimate object like, you know, puppets or animation or changing an actor's performance on screen. I mean, there's a potency about the moving picture and sound and music that you can just have. It can be a very powerful medium, you know.
And do you find it hard to disconnect then from the world of music and creating music in your head?
Well, I notice that I don't listen to a lot of music, you know. So I'm a bit of an island as a result, but intentionally so, but also yeah. Because just in my, I think there's always music. So I'm not even kind of aware of the amount of music, other than I find myself unable to kind of leave the music station on in the background. I have to turn it off. Unless it's a song I like where I turn it off, you know what I mean? But so that kind of level of white noise is, it's more talk radio than music radio, I find.
Yeah, I was going to say, because it must be quite difficult listening to other people's music, because I guess you're probably analysing it in your head unknown to yourself subconsciously.
Yeah, well, I think in a way you've, it's a bit like theatre actors going to the theatre, or, you know, actors going to see films that we have all seen the wizard behind the curtain, you know what I mean? In the Wizard of Oz terms. So, but with that said, having said that, I mean, there is at the same time, something magical and, you know, sacred about the creative arts, you know, and I don't kind of say that lightly. So there is, and I think it is that level of kind of make-believe and fantasy and imagination and magic that actually keeps us young as artists and keeps us engaged and stops you drying up and becoming a cynical and bitter twisted.
It's good to know you have that.
you have to be a volunteer.
Yeah. Cool. Now, you're actually coming to Brighton in a few days' time. You're coming on the Saturday, the 21st of May. You're playing at the Unitarian Church from 9:30 to 10 p.m. and that's part of the Great Escape Festival. That's going to be an amazing venue for your music, I think. What do you have planned? What are you going to perform there?
Well, 30 minutes, yeah, it'll be fleeting, but yeah, I'm really looking forward to it. Myself, and it'll be a three-piece, myself and Catherine Fitzgerald will be with me on keyboard, and another Callum Quirney, friend of mine, from Dublin, he'll be playing guitar and bouzouki and ukulele and different things. My setup is that I travel with a kind of a looping pedal setup, so I accompany myself, and then as well as that, I'll have Callum and Catherine with me. But I suppose it's my music. I would describe it, if I were pushed, as being something between Planksy and Philip Glass. So, you know, it's a bit of a somewhere in between those two points.
Yeah, should be really, really good. And it's your first time coming to Brighton as well, you were saying.
Yeah, I mean, unbelievably so. The Flames toured far and wide across Britain, and for some reason we never got to Brighton. Wow. We would have been big fans of Quadrophenia back in the day. So
yeah. Wow. Well, I'll give you one tip for Brighton, and that's, if you're going to eat something, just watch out for the seagulls if you're eating outdoors.
Oh yeah, okay, yeah, I've heard that actually. Yeah,
they're pretty vicious. There's a few cafes actually that have signs up that say watch out for seagulls. So it's a bit of an issue. So watch out for that. That's the Brighton tip for you.
Great, thanks, Anthony.
Cool, Colin. Thanks very much for talking to us, and the best of luck. Are you touring the rest of the year, or what's the plan for 2016?
I think there is talk of doing something later in the year, doing a tour in the UK, and that will be probably in September, October.
Perfect, okay. So we can just check out the website for more details there.
That's it, yeah.
Cool, Colin. Thanks very much for talking to us. Thank you.
My pleasure. Take care.
From the heart of Brighton, a taste of home.
The other sort of people I pass and I touch and I shake my head.
Yeah, probably.
I'm kitted out in all the proper gear.
Brighton's weekly Irish radio show. What's the Crack? With Anthony Martin on Radio Reverb, 97.2 FM. See whatsthecrack.co.uk and radioreverb.com for showtimes.